Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Service Without Excuses podcast brought to you by Sotellus, sotellus.com/Rob Lyon. You can go there and do a great demo and check out the world's best review management software. I use it my own business, newjerseysbest.com or New Jersey's Best Carpet and Tile Cleaning. But you can go visit them and it's a real game changer for your business. Reviews are a big part of it. In fact, our guest today, we're going to talk about reviews, and I was reading over his website and it had some very, very glowing reviews and the importance of getting other people's opinions. But Sotellus is a program we use in ours and we send out to every single one of our customers afterwards to get their feedback. And it's a major, major portion of our future business. People tend to book us without asking about a price necessarily based on a reputation that we've built up with others over time and been very grateful to do so. So we have a guest on today. I've been wanting to get on for a while. He's a fellow musician. I do not get to interview very many working fellow musicians. And this gentleman, Joe, has a full-time, I believe it's full-time band at this point in time that specializes in private events and weddings and things like that. But Joe has been a brand name on the Jersey Shore in this region for quite some time. But I want to introduce our guest, Mr. Joe Barricata. Am I saying that correctly?
You are, Rob. Awesome.
Please tell our guests a little bit about yourself and how you ended up here today.
Well, I'd say the first thing, if you have a weird name like me, always change it to Lynch or something easy. So, I mean, the fact that we've even gotten to the point we are with my last name is a testament in itself. But you want me to go back to like when I was a kid and how I started music, or you want me to just get right into the business part of it?
You can go back as far as you want and how you ended up here today, because really people like to hear a story of how somebody got somewhere. You know, look at the Starbucks founder, and he started in the housing projects of Brooklyn. So when he talks about a story, he goes all the way back. So I don't think that would be a bad idea at all, actually.
All right, cool. Well, like most kids, when I saw Kiss, I'm 51, so I was born in 1970, which is always easy to remember how old I am. I wanted to be Peter Criss, so I begged my mom to, you know, get me a drum set, but I started out with a little drum pad for like 10 bucks. I did every Buddy Rich rudiment book, and I got like flying with that. It finally bought me a drum set. So fast forward to the sixth grade. I guess I always had that, like, I was always the kid that put the wiffle ball teams together. So there's always that, I guess you'd call it leadership qualities, or, you know, as I learned later on through the books I read. But anyway, so we put a band together in the sixth grade. We did the talent show. We played Stairway to Heaven, and all the kids were behind me going, when are you coming in? Because it doesn't come in for like 6 minutes in Stairway to Heaven. I spent 3 months learning that little riff that John Bonham does. So anyway, musically, I was a drummer up till about 14. Then I saw Randy Rhoads, and that just inspired me to just start playing guitar. And obviously in the 80s, guitar was it. So obviously I always loved Van Halen, but most people that know me don't realize I know more Van Halen from the Alex Van Halen standpoint. And we actually did a show at Bar A with some amazing guitar players. And for some reason, none of them wanted to do the solo spotlights. So I had to learn Spanish Fly, and I broke my hand last year and I was panicking, but we had a great time. Anyway, so I had a band in high school. We did that whole thing. Then I joined a band from a bunch of guys in Brooklyn that were older than me. And without knowing, that taught me, like, you know, you are your surroundings. So if you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room. So they were older than me. So I was able to learn a lot from them, from a music standpoint, from a life standpoint, from songwriting and all that kind of stuff. And that band, we went from hair metal, you know, like a Zeppelin kind of, Whitesnake kind of band. That band ended up being like a Deftones, Pantera kind of band. We actually toured with Type O Negative, did a lot of shows at L'Amour's. Ken Creedy, who managed L'Amour's and also Type O Negative and Life Agony, he was sort of managing us for a while. And, you know, we did great with that. I mean, literally the night that I had my engagement party, you know, me and my wife literally went to the China Club in New York and did a gig at like 2 a.m. So that band was amazing. You don't make money in that, you know, and I left to get married and started doing covers, and that band got signed, and I was insanely depressed. Not that I got married, but, you know, they're telling me about touring in Germany. They used the snare from STP and stuff like that. And I'm sitting there doing American Girl in bars, because the way I started the Joe Barricata thing is I started doing solo acoustic singing. And just to note that I never sang before. So I didn't really start singing until I was like 29, 30. And I used to have to drink a lot of alcohol So there was like a six shot, six beer before this show started at this pub in Rahway that I really grinded my voice singing, because I think singing's like working out. You know, the more you start working out, you know, that whole deal. But so now we're getting into the Joe Barricata thing. So we went to the Boathouse one night and went to see the Billy Lawler band, who are actually doing his son's wedding coming up. And I'm honored to do it because he's sort of like my mentor. And I walked in that place and I'm like, where's the band? Because it's packed and there's no stage and they're wearing these ear things like Sammy Hagar. So anyway, so I get to know Billy, and Billy throws my name to the Boathouse, and he helped me get in the Parker House. And back then, the Parker House and the Boathouse had, they had such big names as clubs that I started putting a band together. And it was really, it's not like today. Like, I noticed bands get in the Parker House in certain places like overnight. Like, young bands don't realize the grind that us old cats had to do. And you know, believe it or not, I think my band got to a pretty good point now. New rooms, I still got to kiss butt and, you know, beg or whatever it is. It's a weird thing. Like, some rooms do reach out to me, and that's where I'll get into the, it's really, I'd rather do private events because, you know, it's a little different. But anyway, so about 20 years ago, the band started playing, and, you know, we did the whole every Friday, Saturday band night, Boathouse, O'Neill's, like you name the bar, whatever was happening at the time. We did in, I did in every, I started doing like solo acoustic at the Parker House. And then like the next year, my bass player finally joined. And so I convinced them to pay him to come in. So Chris and I like really grinded our teeth for years doing acoustic gigs. Every Sunday at the Boathouse, blah, blah, blah. Wherever I can get a gig, I would do a gig. So, you know, the band sort of grew from there. And that's, you know, we would play O'Neill's and it would be like the Joe Bacaduda band. You know, and we're out for like 12 years already. And I'm like, really, man? I'm like, you know, like, yeah, you know, it's just, it is what it is, you know? At the end of the day, I was just glad that we had a gig. So anyway, as far as learning the business side of it, you know, there was some bands on the scene that hated when I came around, because I guess we were good. Like, some of the groupies would say, like, they hate you because you're good and stuff. So they wouldn't help me. But there were also other bands out there, like I'll say that, like Pat Roddy. Pat Roddy's always been a good man to me. And, you know, I always support him and help him out in any way I can. So, you know, he helped me get in the columns, and he would tell me what he got at rooms, blah, 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 and stuff like that. So, you know, and I always sort of ran the band like as a business, where I pay the band and, you know, like I run it like a business kind of thing. And obviously I take care of my guys. And, you know, I've talked to some other big band leaders over the years and figured out how they do stuff. But, you know, as far as the wedding end of it, a lot of bands don't realize, like, to go out and spend $5,000 on a video. And I tell people that hire us, sometimes people go, how come you don't have a professional video? I go, you mean a lip sync video like Milli Vanilli? I go, and we actually did one and it sucked. I got rid of it. I couldn't stand looking at it. But, you know, a lot of bands think you're going to spend a lot of money, do a video and get big money for weddings. And it doesn't work that way. And it really happened organically for us. And I'm sure a lot of other top wedding bands or event bands would say the same thing. Like, I certainly didn't get into doing covers to do weddings, because at the time I looked at weddings as a bunch of old farts, like, you know, playing like jazz standards, you know, right. It wasn't fun. Now it's a different scene. Weddings are like, you can almost do the same set as a wedding as you do as a bar now. It's strange. Like, 15 years ago, if you played My Girl, you'd get a beer bottle thrown at you. Now it's like everything works. So we organically grew into a wedding band. And it just happened by, like you mentioned, like the referrals. I started to figure out how certain things were working in the industry. I knew from a previous business I did that was annoying on getting on calls. You know, whenever you do a sales business, I built a previous sales team of like 5,000 people. And I won't even say the business it was in, because it is, you know, but one thing, it led me to read a ton of books. I became a huge fan of like John Maxwell, you know, Les Brown, all the names that are big now. You name it, I probably listened to the audio or read the book, like all the books there, like, you know, you name it, Think and Grow Rich, all the way to like Tribes from Seth Godin. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, if you're a band leader, read Tribes. That's probably the best book for that kind of thing. But I read so many books and audiobooks. I was a mailman at the time. So instead of digesting 101.5, I I started to digest audiobooks. So I would listen to about, well, I would always listen to an audiobook the way I would listen to a song. So what I would tell my sales team at the time, and I'm like, did you listen to that audio? They'd say, no. And I'd say, you know, if a bride called me and said, did you learn our wedding song? They'd say, yeah, listen to it once. And I said, if a bride called me and said, hey, tomorrow our wedding song, you know, like You're My Best Friend from Queen, did you learn it? If I told her, yeah, listen to it once, I think I'm in pretty bad shape, because she's thinking, wait, once? What are you talking about once? So I started listening to audiobooks the way I would listen to a song, like learning Rosalita back in the day. I did not grow up a Springsteen fanatic, even though now I am, because learning his songs, you learn what an amazing, you know, political stuff aside, because the world's like...
Incredible songwriter.
Yeah, the world's so batshit crazy with politics, but Springsteen, like, is just an incredible songwriter. And when you learn his songs and play his songs, you realize the energy that it brings. And that's why he built such a following. But I heavily immersed myself in what they call personal development. So I listened to tons of books like that. You know, and it's funny because personal development, there's business development and then there's personal development. And they are one the same, but they're not. So, you know, it just taught me a lot about, you know, how to treat people, how to look at myself in the mirror and say, well, why doesn't that bar want to book me? Or why didn't that guy want to sit down and listen to my business opportunity? Like, self-reflection, I think, is the biggest part of personal development. So, you know, and honestly, like I mentioned when we were talking before we got on, I was your typical bar singer that didn't mind getting hammered every gig, you know? Right. Obviously, we do weddings now, and I don't really do that anymore. But so my way that led me from a kid wanting to be Peter Kirst to where I am now, obviously, it was a span of like 30, 40-something years. I'm 51 now. But, you know, it was definitely a journey, and it still is a journey. It's funny, like, you know, like I always try to meet with people that you know, are ahead of me, and I have, and, you know, like, you always learn, like, two ears, one mouth, you know, like, and when I do, I shut my mouth and I listen, even if I think I might know more than them, or they're telling me something I know already. You know, you can learn more from a 20-minute conversation than you can learn from reading any book. So, you know, it really helped me get where I am now, the whole personal development thing. And I still try to download audiobooks every once in a while and listen to what I can, or go back, like Stephen Covey, the Seven Habits of Successful People. I think I listened to that book like 500 times. You know, I got to the point where it's like I can almost recite the book, and Tribes and certain books from the day. Unfortunately, I think personal development is just like 80s hair metal. Once you get Bon Jovi, there's going to be a million other clones underneath it writing the same book. So you can eventually buy books that you realize, like, oh man, they're ripping off Think and Grow Rich, or they're ripping off this. But so I sort of pulled back on that kind of stuff, because it's almost like a great artist. Like, you got Springsteen, Billy Joel, like even some new artists. And once you master them, you're good. And then you try to make your own thing out of it. So
I was just thinking about something. I don't mean to cut you off, but Jason Mraz, you of course know that name. Jason Mraz was started his career in San Diego coffee shops with Toko, that the percussionist that was in his band, or is in his band, I think, to this day. And he talked about, you know, somebody said, Jason, it's awesome. I mean, you're like one of a kind to come out there and be that kind of a songwriter and that kind of a performer. And how does it feel to be at the top of your game? Because I don't know. I got a guy that I grew up with right down the street from me in San Diego that just destroys anything I ever did or ever write. The only difference is I got in the right place at the right time. And I got, he goes, it wasn't, like you said, an overnight success. Nothing is an overnight success. It took me 20 years digging out in coffee houses and bars and whatever to get known to be able to this person. He goes, and I had to grow into being a good songwriter. I didn't start out a good songwriter. If you listen to our first album, it's very immature compared to the later albums. And he goes, and that comes from experience and time. But when people make comments like, you know, you're one of a kind, I know five guys from my neighborhood in San Diego that put me to shame. They're better writers, they're better players, better musicians. I just was in the right place at the right time under the right circumstances. You were saying something really quick, well, over the period of the conversation, you had a path of how you got there. You had a mentor in Pat that helped you introduce you to people, but he more or less also taught you about how to do that, how to get in, how to make those connections with people, how to just open the door, and then you can take it from there. And then the personal development side kept you in check when it came to the logistics of how to do it, how to run it as a business. As I said before, there is no harder, and I've said this many times on this podcast, no business harder than the music business. One of my best friends has been doing it professionally for 25 years. I've had him on here. He's an SEO guy. I know what it is on my end. I don't do it full time. I can't do it full time. I just have so many other business interests, it'd be impossible. But I know the hard work that goes into that, to the business side of it. And I always looked at it, and I'm sure you have as well, that if you're working for somebody, you know, you're working for a private event, that's a wedding, that's one thing. A private event, same thing. But when you're cutting your teeth in nightclubs, like you talk about, you know the chunk coming in has to be more than the chunk going out. And if you're playing for a bar or a club, and it doesn't matter how good the band is and how good they put on the show, if they can't put bodies in the room, and bodies in the room, I mean not just people that show up and drink water, maybe smoke something else, whatever that happens to be, they got to come in, they got to drink, they got to drink some alcohol, they got to spend some money, they got to be buyers. They're not going to be people that are spending $10 at the bar. They got to be people spending $100 per person at the bar or better. You know, if you're not able to produce that revenue, you can't consistently maintain that relationship because the chunk coming in is not nearly as big as the chunk going out. And then your relationship becomes strained.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. It probably didn't dawn on me that talent doesn't mean a thing. I mean, it does. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I think our band, we're all very good musicians and we sound tight. But at the end of the day, in the bar scene, people want to come out and be entertained. Like if you look at like David Lee Roth, I mean, I'm sure you do too. I love Van Halen, but he's horrific. You know, he can't sing, but you know what? I'll still go see Van Halen because they give you a feeling. It's like, you know, so there's some, I mean, I get texts sometimes from people that are like, that band sucks. And I'm like, listen, if you want to be negative, that's your deal. But it's not a competition of who can play YYZ. Or, you know, I usually tell brides when we're going over songs for the wedding, I tell them, like, I have zero personal attachment to the songs that Joe Barracata Band plays. I like the reaction they get. So 90% of the songs we play, I wouldn't say I don't like them. I like playing them, but I wouldn't listen to them. If I can make a living, I'm making now doing a Van Halen tribute band, done. Right. But you can't. You know what I mean? Right. It's just, I'd love to go out there and play Eruption and do like, you know, Sinner Swing and Dirty Movies, Push Comes to Shove, stuff that, believe it or not, when we did that Van Halen show, half the Van Halen band guys didn't even know those songs. Like, even the band didn't know the B-side stuff. So yeah, like that club owner, for the most part, is they're in business to sell food and liquor, and they don't care if you play American Girl better than Joe Barracata Band or Rock Bottom. They don't care. They don't, as long as they just want you to bring a crowd. So without a doubt, the cover band scene in New Jersey, which is amazing, and we all should feel blessed that we're a part of it, no matter what kind of money we make. And make no bones about it. If, you know, they're looking for the cheapest band that brings in the biggest crowd, and that's because they're bar owners. And if they've been around for a while, they understand it. I mean, like I just built over the pandemic, probably the best relationship I have with bars, with Barrette. And it happened over the last 2 or 3 years. I always thought they hated me because I played Boathouse in certain rooms, you know, right. But you just never know. And, you know, I always keep the door open with anyone, and I try not to burn bridges as much as I can. You know, it's funny, even as a musician, and if any musicians are watching this, I can't tell you how many musicians are like, oh, you want me for New Year's? It's $17,000. And I'm like, you know, less, you know, you got to understand, like, you know, and again, it's, listen, some musicians are worth their worth and they want their money. And I'm not talking about any particular person. It happened over the last like 5 or 6 years. You know, like I don't overcharge for certain things, and I'd rather build a relationship even with my wedding couples, and they know it from the get-go. Like I don't come off like a shrewd businessman, because every wedding couple, a private event person that hires me, to me is like gold to me and their family. Like if you help me, you know, buy my dog's vaccines or whatever, you know, I'm sure you like Billy Sheehan, you're a bass player. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I remember he's like, there's not a thing I own that I didn't buy through music. So I personally feel insanely blessed that somehow I figured out a way to make a living doing this, which, as you said, it is the most craziest business out there. It make as much as it doesn't make sense, it does. And it all boils down to simplicity. Where people, like when I used to do that business that, you know, I mean, literally, we went to a convention and there was an 8-foot poster of me sitting there in a friggin' suit. And, you know, I used to say on stage, I would give motivational speeches in front of like, you know, 1,000 people and everyone's in suits and who owns this business. And they're looking up to me like Joey, the drinking bar singer, like, how did you do it? And I'd be like, how did I do what? Like what? They thought there was some kind of magic potion and they didn't understand it wasn't, you know, and, you know, it was really. Everything in life is relationship building. I mean, you and I hooking up with this podcast through music, we both admire each other, you know, and it was like, you know, if we didn't like each other, this wouldn't happen, you know? So it's like everything is it's a relationship thing. And if you see, I mean, there's some bands that have been around for a long time that should be further on or maybe aren't, or, you know, and a lot of times it's not having the goal, you know, setting goals on certain things. I mean, without a doubt in this band, like I set goals. Do I hit them all? Absolutely not, you know, and you're going to fail. You're going to, you know, like failing and stuff. But, you know, I always say the most important part to any business is whoever's leading the charge. You need to have a team that believes in you and you need to have a team that's going to get behind you and, you know, go to war with you. I mean, let's face it, in this music business, we're all friends, but we're all at war at the same time. Like if you don't think there's anyone trying to take your lunch, you're out of your mind. They all want your lunch. Whoever's ahead of you, you want that position at the same time of being cool about it. You know, like we're actually going to do some shows this year with other bands, which is unheard of. Like if you think about it, I'm sure we're similar in age. When we came up, it would be like 3 bands playing a night. And I know now because it's money involved. So like I'm really, you know, Eddie Test is a wonderful guy.
And
I even told him he's one of my inspirations. You know, I'm like, you do 3-hour sets, you know, shit, he blows me away, you know? So we're going to do a show in March. We'll announce that. I'm doing a show with the Smoking Jackets, for, you know, Tom Generone from Bar A and Scott Angle. A lot of great guys in that band. I mean, they're such a fun band. I almost look at them as like Steel Panther of the Jersey Shore scene. Like they make a joke of playing and they play fun stuff and people like to see them. You know, it goes beyond if certain guys are popular in the band. You know, if you don't put on a fun performance, no one's going to keep coming to see you.
You're just saying something key right there. And, you know, something that was always important. And yeah, we are very close in age. Performance was a big level when I was young. We had the long hair. I'm sure you did as well. And you had the moves. In fact, I got to put on for Halloween, I got to put on a wig and try to move the hair similar to what I did or whatever back in the day. And showmanship was always an important part. So I love it when people would say, oh, we didn't have to put on the... You did. You had to be musically really good back then because everybody was very competitive as far as a player. I grew up in Pennsylvania. I didn't grow up in New York or New Jersey. But everybody was very competitive and who was the best guitar player. And I started out as a guitar player and then switched to bass a long time ago. But everybody was competitive. And then on top of which, you had to have the showmanship. And if you didn't have the showmanship, you never brought anybody. So it didn't matter how good the band sounded. I always go back to White Lion. Okay. White Lion was, from a guitar player standpoint, Vito was one of the best of all time, flat out. Totally inspired by Eddie Van Halen, openly admitted it.
They were managed by Lamours.
By Lamours, exactly. But Mike Tramp was a mediocre vocalist, good singer, incredible stage presence. Had the look, had the presence, and that's what's so. So when people say, well, it has to be musically the best person, well, Mike Tramp was not the best singer. Vito Bratto is one of the better guitar players. Lomenzo, incredible bass player. They all were great musicians, but it came down to showmanship and being able to put on the show.
They wrote good songs.
Yeah, and they wrote good songs. They did. But there's a lot of bands, I think you know this, that write incredible songs that we never heard of. I can think of, I have cassettes, I have boxes of cassettes, I don't know why I still have them, to be honest with you, of bands that I listened to back in the 80s and 90s that were like, they were like the shit, they were everything, people loved them, they really, and then you look at them now and go, who are they? Wait a minute, I watched a video of a band called Hardline, which Neil Schon was in, incredible band, incredible singer, 2 brothers were in the band, and I haven't heard of them in years, and this is Dean Castronovo, Journey, Neil Schon, Journey, all these people, Interactive. The thing is, people are attracted to that magnetic personality. I had a friend of mine. He was a country singer back in Pennsylvania, country band. The name of the band was called Tommy Guns. Tommy Delaney's his real name. I don't know if the band's even still around, but they would draw the biggest crowds. Okay. So the rest of us might draw, you know, 100 people. That would be a really good night. He would draw 800 people, 1,000 people to a room. He had to have a room capable of fitting 800,000 people. And Tommy taught me this years later. And you look at it back then, you're kind of a young buck and you're like, yeah, he's a very good entertainer. Not the greatest singer in the world, but he's a great entertainer. And he's a nice guy. And I liked it. And I always thought, that's a good guy. And then he taught me one day his secret. He comes 2 hours before a show. Crew's setting up everything. He's a big act. He's not setting up anything. And he gets to meet every single person in the room. Talks to them, gets to find out their story. Once he's known their story a little bit more, then doesn't have to spend as much time talking to them because it's like, hey, how's this? How's this? Boom, next person. He learned the art of listening, like you said before, 2 ears and 1 mouth, listening to what people's stories were. And then he would give them an example of how his story was and maybe how they had some parallels between the two of them. If you think he didn't bring more people back, I mean, I watched that guy go from 50 people in a room to 1,000 people in a room consistently.
Well, you know what he did? You ever hear the saying, no one hears what you say, but they know how you made them feel.
Very true.
So, you know, when you have a conversation with someone, if, you know, they're hearing what you're saying, but more or less the way you made them feel.
Right.
You know, just like when people say that, you know, what's the favorite word you like to hear? It's Rob. Me, it's Joe. Like, you want to hear your first name. And, you know, I'll say this with our band, and it goes to everyone in my band, too. Like, we really do know our audience or our crowd or our following, you know, whatever you want to say. And, you know, it, to me, it's like there'd be no show if no one's coming to see you. So, like, right. At the end of the day, like, there. And, like, I even tell, like, you know, when we book a wedding or I meet with – I like meeting with wedding couples, even though with the pandemic it was weird, but now I do. I like to get to know them, and I let them know, you know, they're my boss that day. You know what I mean? So like we just hired a sound man, Ryan, and I met him at Bar A, and it's funny how that organically built too. And we're actually having a band dinner tonight. Like, I'm taking the band out to my buddy's place, Fratellas and Seagirt. We're going to hang out, have a few drinks and, you know, just be like a family tonight. And, you know, Ryan really built something nice for himself too. And I've been guiding him a little bit, but he's doing a lot of it himself, but I beat him to weddings. And if you think about it, if I'm that typical band leader, like I think I'm the man, I'd show up 10 minutes before. And, you know, I've heard stories of band leaders leaving like 2 minutes after the wedding ends or the gig ends. And it's like, you're not even talking to people.
Right.
You know, so I get there early. I let the bride and groom see me like, oh, Joe's here 4 hours before the wedding starts. Like, I'm there. I'm making sure nothing. Because, you know, I mean, even if this wasn't my band technically, like, because like my band knows if they're going to be late, they text me. I panic. You know, when you have like 8 to 10 guys you're dealing with on any given circumstance. And it's funny. I think my old sax player, the sax man, Rich Casey, who will be there tonight. He's like family. I think he said Duke Ellington or something, said like, I'd rather play with someone I can have coffee with the next morning than someone that's just an amazing musician.
True.
And, you know, not that I'm saying guys in my band aren't great musicians, but with me, it's always been like, I think when I hit 30, I realized that when I was 20, when in my 20s, I was a real prick. I was like, if you're not on my level, I'm not playing with you. And I looked back at that and said, oh, no wonder why that bass player don't like me, or that, you know, that second guitar player of the band I joined is like, yeah, Joe's a prick. Cause I was, you know, cause I looked at it like, listen, I can riff and I can learn songs in 3 seconds. If you can't, we shouldn't be playing with each other. But, you know, obviously I've grown and learned through the years, you know, about that. So, I mean, I'm very blessed with the band I have. Like, they're great. You know, like I said, we all look at it like it's us against the world. And they've told me many a times, like, there's been a lot of decisions I've made that they questioned at the time, and they thank me. And they're like, whatever you're doing, we're behind you. Cause I've proven to them, like, when they say like, you can't be a leader without doing it. Like as silly as this sounds, like we did a few gigs last year and I got pretty banged up at some bar gigs, you know, and vice versa. So, you know, I told a few band members, like, listen, like, we can't do that anymore. And I'm going to not get banged up. I mean, at weddings, I never drink. Even if the bride and groom say you can drink, it's too nerve wracking. But we did some bar gigs this year where, you know, we let loose and had fun. But just at the end of the day, the show is more important than how banged up we can get.
You're bringing up something real quick. I talked to another colleague of mine that has a very well-established wedding private band too, also in Jersey, more up toward North Jersey. And I was saying, I had a common friend, Chris Galace, and last week he had a Christmas party at the Shore House. And he asked me to learn 10 Christmas songs. Okay. Now, Rock Bottom hasn't learned 10 Christmas songs, but we're learning 10 Christmas songs. And I said, I learned, and Rich said to me, Rich, the gentleman I was speaking to, said, did you learn all 10 songs? I was like, it never occurred to me not to learn 10 songs. And I says, the difference between a pro is not about how many gigs they've played, how long they've been playing, how good they really are at their instrument. It's about how trustworthy they are to learn the craft and learn the parts they're supposed to be doing. If you're working a job, you have to learn that job. Well, that's part of learning that job. You have to learn those parts. And one of the things I know I could see from the outside looking in with you guys, everybody comes there knowing their parts and being ready for the game. Okay. It's no different than football. It's no different than any other thing. In football, if a player is weak or isn't on their game, the other players will gladly ride him back into the game, or you won't stay on that team. It's that simple. It's the same thing in the music business. We're all there together to work together, but everybody has to put their 110%. One of the Tom Brady, the legend, you know, no matter whether you love him or hate him, you have to admit that that guy's the greatest, and he will never ask somebody to do something he's not fully ready and willing to do himself. He works harder, longer, and puts more effort in. And the guy is what, 44? Okay.
Yeah, he's undeniable at this point.
You got to look at the standpoint that he plays harder than anyone else. And any quarterback, you talk to anyone in the NFL that actually physically knows him, they'll tell you the reason Tom Brady's successful is because he plays harder and he'll bring it harder. And he expects you to bring it. He doesn't expect you to play to his level. He expects you to play to your best level.
Right.
I think that's the definition of a true leader, especially in the music business or in sports or in anything, is being able to bring out the best in the people you have. And you'll find that even if the musicians are not world-class musicians, and they're very good musicians, but they're not at that level, you're still better off playing with them. I learned this in the studio too, as well, doing studio work. I'd be in a room with people that I should have never been in that room. Hmm. Never in that category. These people are world-class musicians. And I asked a contractor once, and a contractor is the person that brings you in and says, I want you to be the person to fill this slot. How the hell did I end up here? It's easy. You're workable. You're likable. You listen. You do what they're asking you to do. You don't question it. You don't go, oh, that's stupid. That's lame. You would never use those words. You do what's asked of you. And if they say, well, can we try something else or do something else? You go, okay. And you find an alternative to what it is. That is a pro.
You know, it was a great book that maybe you read it. My bass player gave it to me. It was the band leader of the Tonight Show. I can't remember his name.
Paul Schaefer?
That's
Letterman. I'm sorry.
Jay Leno, I think.
Okay.
Anyway, it's called There's No Traffic on the Extra Mile. Mm. It was an easy read. I think I have a few copies because when I was doing that sales thing, I'd buy books and give it to my team and stuff. But sure, that was a great book. And he mentioned stuff like that. Like, I can't remember. I haven't read it in a while. But he mentioned a lot of his mistakes. And he mentioned why he figured out he got gigs, because he was, like you said, he was the guy to call. Like, I have horn players that I used a few times that they go into my, you know, break glass if needed list. Right. Like, I just enjoy playing with them. They would nickel and dime me with money, whatever. And then I have guys that every gig I throw them, I get a thank you the next day. Mm-hmm. So, but it's funny how people don't realize, like, you know, it's like when you're the leader of the band, and again, I treat everyone with respect no matter what, but you know, it's like, I usually try to keep calling people back that the whole band, like I'm definitely not a tyrant in this band. There's no doubt I'm the boss of the band, the leader, but I don't really act like it. Right. Like, if anyone gets fired from this band, we always say, if you get fired from this band, you pretty much fired yourself. I always got to do the dirty work and sit down with someone and say, hey, like, it ain't happening. But it's always like, I have to have my whole band's backing for it.
Right.
Because, like, I think in October, which was insane, and next October, we have a crazy month. We had 12 weddings this October, which I never thought in a million years I'd even, you know, could even achieve that. And my piano player is like, you know, I had dinner with you guys more than my family this month. So we're around each other a lot. Right. So there's certain guys in my band that we bicker like brothers, you know, like we can get under each other's skin. Like I'm sure you guys kind of rock bottom.
Yeah.
But, you know, we always know at the end of the day, it's for a goal of either just, you know, and I'm always the first guy that, you know, because you got to sort of know your tendencies, you know? So if I know, if I ever feel like I might've talked to someone the wrong way or didn't act the way I should have, I'll always apologize to someone. I'll be the first to be like, hey man, you know, if I came off wrong at rehearsal last night or whatever, like, I just want, you know, I apologize for it. Because right. I was a mailman for 20 years and that job really taught me, you know, it's funny how when someone shits on you or someone treats you bad, you should actually thank them.
Right.
And you should thank them because they taught you how not to treat people. So what I learned in the post office, they literally treat you like dog shit. And when we were doing Friday night gigs, I mean, there was a point where the scene was kicking. We can get 3-4 gigs a month with a band. And I would always say, like, if I was driving to do this gig and I'm the leader of the band, I was in a band where the leader was a complete moron.
Right.
And they're still around. I don't know how. And he has band members come in and out like crazy. They're not a big Jersey band, but they've been around a long time. So it always just taught me, like, listen, if someone's coming to play in your band, you better make them want to be there.
Right.
You know, and that's a matter of respecting people. And listen, no one's perfect. You know, you know, it's very tough to be perfect all the time. But, you know, I've noticed, and I probably should get back more into it. I noticed, you know, your mind's like a muscle. Like when I was really reading books, like, you know, as a mailman, I would read books all day long in the mail truck. I'd have the in-ears going. It actually keeps you on your toes more.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And listen, if you ever have, we have each other's cells, like text me books, man. You know, I'm always down and I'll do the same. Like you never know what book affects someone. And like, you know, you can, what do they say? Like a $10 book can like bring you in like, you know,
millions,
$500,000 over your life.
Yeah. I mean, information is, I always, and I put this on the Facebook group that I'll post this on to, but I put a post up and it was Elon Musk basically implying that, you know, a college degree means jack shit. Okay. If you're not going to apply it and do anything with it, it doesn't make it. So I've always said before this, I even read this, is intelligence is applied. It's not learned. Okay. So you can learn something. You can go to a college. I'm a shitty test taker. You know why? Because I'll analyze it 6 different ways. I'll come up with 6 different answers. It may not be the answer you're looking for, which is why I'm a shitty test taker.
Right.
But it's still 6 different reasons why you can look at something and say, okay, it could be this, it could be this, it could be this, it could be this. And when you go and you're taking a test, the instructor basically has to say, yeah, but that's not what I taught you this answer. Again, terrible test taker, probably why I'm self-employed. But it's the ability to sit there and look through things and see different opportunities. And when you read a book, you read the same book I'm going to read, you're going to have a little different impression than I'm going to have. Why? Because you're coming from your mindset, your background, and you're saying, I learned this from this. This is what I was able to take away from it. And I'm going to say I was able to take away from this. When you put all that together, that's one brain trust right there. That's something you learn from. I tell people the education you see back there, that's $100,000 sitting on that shelf. Why? It's $100,000 of useless information if I don't use it, but I can tell you I've made millions from what's sitting on that shelf.
Right.
You know, because I've applied it. I've done it. Have I read everything on there? Hell no. I've read probably 20% of that thing. And it's in videos, it's DVDs. Most of my stuff's all digital. It's categorized. It's on a server now. It's totally irrelevant to what it is. But you learn those things and you take that task no matter what you do in life. You learn how can I use this as an example in not only my personal growth, but also in whatever I'm doing to facilitate around me. If I'm facilitating my business, I'm facilitating parts of the music business, part of the band business. I've never looked at it, and I want to get into this in a second. I've never looked at the business, man business, from the standpoint of the common thing. I'm looking at chicks. I'm looking at hot chicks. I'm looking at whatever. I don't care about that. Not that it's a bad thing. I'm all about, you know, whatever eye candy's out there. However, I am looking at, are the bartenders staying busy? Are the servers staying busy? Are they serving alcohol? Are they serving wine? Are they serving hard drinks? Are they bringing out a bunch of shots to people? Are they continuing to move? Those are the variables I look at from being a bar band guy, because that's what makes us money. And if people are not having a good time, or our entertainment level is not there, or the band was a little off tonight or whatever, I can look at it and say, okay, what? Why didn't we connect with people to make them or want them to purchase more products in a bar, more drinks, more food? Stick around. The other thing, too, that we found is if we get them, we keep them. So even if we're there and we found a consistent system to this, it's not just a one-time deal. We can go into any room. We're lucky enough from that standpoint where if you have 50 people, 49 of them are going to stay. And whatever else comes in, comes in. It's our job to get 49 to stay. Right. It's our job not to chase 40 out. Like the old term, you can do good, do no harm. I'm saying that wrong. You can always do good, do no harm. No matter what you do, do no harm. You know, you got to make sure whatever you got, you're not going to make it a worse situation. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about in detail is you are obviously a professional organization. I've never actually seen the band live. I've got to get time to get out to see it. I've seen plenty of videos. I know Robin. I know some of your other members of the band. High energy, great show. And the one thing I really commended, because the businessman in me, and that's where I'm going with this, looks at it and says, that's a brilliant business model, much like Brian Kirk and the Jerks. I'm friends with Brian, and he's made a business model of it too, as well, over the years. Brian's a brand name when it comes to what he does. And you look at it and say, you know, when a person is making a decision for their biggest day of their life, their wedding, or a private event where they're hosting it, could be a corporate event. You know, you're the one that's going out there and purchasing the entertainment. But more importantly, even weddings, you have one wedding, one opportunity. In the business, in my regular business, I can go out and make a mistake and fix the mistake. You can't fix a mistake in a wedding. You're going to have mistakes because that's just human nature. But you can't make a big error at a wedding because you can't go back to a second day of a wedding. There's no second day of a wedding. It's very, very important to bring it the first time. And the one thing I've told people, when you're going to hire an act, and this is over the years, this is well before Rock Bottom days, whatever the case is, when you're going to hire somebody, look at their reputation, look at their background, do your research, do your due diligence, which is business people you got to do, and figure out if this is the right situation, the right entertainment act for you. And realize that you get what you pay for. So if you're going to hire entertainment and your budget is X, but you really want to have X, you have to find a commonality of what's feasible for you budgetary wise, but you never, ever want to take the risk or do that on something based on, I can only do this because that's all I want to spend. You have to, it's the one time. The example of that is obviously in the business world, we want to, you know, deliver the right service, but we have that flexibility. You don't have that flexibility. I would think it's of the utmost importance when they're going to look at hiring a band like yourself for a wedding to know they're getting top-notch quality, but you're also getting top-notch professionalism. You're getting a product. You're not getting, you can go in, not like grocery store where you go in and there's six of the same products. The top one is the most expensive. In your business and what you're doing, I would think the top product is the only way you'd want to look, because everything else is secondary. You don't want to learn the lesson the hard way. There's no time to learn the second lesson the hard way.
Right. You know, I mean, I guess the best way I'll answer that is two ways. You know, one thing I know that brides always like and they comment on is if you email me, you're getting a response within 5 minutes, because I live on my phone. I mean, who doesn't? I mean, it's pretty sad that these, we might as well put them in our chip ourselves or whatever. But so, you know, when someone's planning their big day, the last thing they want to worry about is this vendor going to be a pain in the ass? Right. So if they know you're reliable right off the bat, that's great. You know, that's huge. It also selling a band is like, I've learned, is like selling cars. So you remember when Hyundais were considered like shit cars?
Right.
Now they're like middle of the road cars.
Right.
So I think most bar, when you start out as a bar band, you're a brand new Hyundai coming on the scene and you got to prove yourself. You're a new Hyundai amongst Jaguars, amongst Audis, amongst all these other brands. So you look for your audience. So when we first started doing weddings, you know, and I didn't figure all this out in my silly little answer I'm giving you, but, you know, I think there's some wedding bands out there that they get to the point where, and even if they're not a Jaguar, they're looking for Jaguar buyers.
Right.
And if you don't match their price, go get a Hyundai. So there's some great bands out there that you can get not at crazy prices. And I think we're like, my band at this point is like moderately priced. We're not like out of control.
Right.
But, you know, so I think as far as a product and I think the reason why we get good reviews is I look at every wedding as the last wedding to get a good review at. So it's like owning a restaurant. If you come to my restaurant and I give you an uncooked burger and, you know, you get sick from it, you're going to get way more press from bad press. That's mm-hmm. going to go like wildfire. So I even kid around with brides and I say, you realize like if I mess up at your wedding, meaning the whole band, it's not, you know, you can only have one or two chances of bombing at a show until your reputation is done.
Right.
So, you know, like, and I think, again, it starts from the leadership of it. And I'll be honest with you, I find it weird calling myself a leader because it's an awkward saying, but I guess in the band I am. You set the tone. So at weddings, the band knows, like, I am as serious as a heart attack. Like, I'm there early. They know, like, I'll say another thing, like, we play a lot at weddings. Like, so, you know, you might hear these bands charging a crazy price and then you find out they played 2 hours at the wedding.
Right.
To me, I'm like, that's what? Like, you know, I don't even say it, yep. You know, but I feel I really give them their money's worth, or we do. It's funny. I almost thought of writing a book, you know, everyone wants to write a book and I'm like, what the hell would I call it with your journey? But at the end of the day, we're in the music business. You're selling like a party. Like, I was going to title the book like Selling the Party. So if a bar owner knows, like, or if a couple knows that they read all these reviews of you and they're great, you know, so it's basically saying like, yeah, the second they started, people on the dance floor. And again, it's not like, it's not rocket science, but it is in a weird way. Cause I've seen some bands fumble in the wedding business because the wedding business is here and the bar business is here and they have nothing to do with each other. It's like football and baseball. They have not, it's the only thing in common is it's a sport. So me personally, like, I definitely stumbled and learned and, you know, fell on my face with the weddings and stuff. But, you know, I think we got it to a point and I hope it continues because this is what I do for a living. So I'll do everything in my power to make it continue. So getting back to the product you're saying, like, so that, you know, Joe Barracata Band's a product. So hiring the right people, like, we were always looking for a great female singer. And it's funny because, you know, I joke with Robin, the big joke with Robin is, you know, and she even said this, and I love Robin like a sister, you know,
right.
She goes, no one wanted me to be in their band until I joined your band. So me and Chris always go, wow, we made a star out of you, like, kidding around. She was already a star. Just no one could see it in her, or no one wanted to take a chance on her for some reason. So with us, she came, we had a few female singers like telling me ridiculous prices they wanted for New Year's wedding. So I'm like, listen, unless you're Mariah Carey, I don't know who's paying you that kind of money. So I reached out to Robin on Facebook. She came, she sang with us at the Columns. After the second or third song, I was like, she matched our energy. We've always been an insanely high energy band. And believe it or not, Robin actually made me a better frontman. Like, she really did. Like, she brought, I'm more of a guitar player. I'm not like Brian Kirk is amazing. Like, I went to see him and I'm like, dude, you're like a Vegas act. Like, holy shit.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And not that, listen, he even said this to me, like, not that I'm trying to be him. No one's going to be him. No one's going to be me.
Exactly.
No one's going to be Rich. No one's going to be Eddie Testa. You always want to be yourself. Right. But, you know, Robin helps me come out of my shell. Cause I was like, how do you do that on stage? She goes, you know what, Joe, I don't give a shit. And if you look at David Lee Roth, you know, Roth actually ripped someone off. I don't know if you know this. There's a guy in that scene, and because I'm like a YouTube nerd, Roth actually completely ripped off a guy's shtick. So it goes to show you, like, imitation, like, everyone's a copy band.
Yeah.
But, you know, so what I wanted to offer as a band, obviously I wanted to gear more towards private events and weddings. So I knew we needed a great female singer. We always had a good horn section. I mean, I'm blessed to have, we play in E flat. So years ago, horn players would be like, Joe E flat, I can't play. So we've been blessed to have horn players that come in and can basically speak German during an English gig. It's like you transpose them.
Right.
But, you know, getting back to building a product, you know, to me, like, And another thing that's sort of like tight to me is like, if you're building a product, you want to protect that product. You don't want your band members playing with every other band. Cause then,
right.
You know, like, why would someone really care to see Rock Bottom if Rich was singing with every other band around town?
Exactly.
Kind of thing. So, and luckily my band's very cool and they like being in our band and blah, blah, blah. Don't get me wrong. I mean, now with COVID, God forbid someone has a wedding and I'm available, or my other guy's available, like go help out that band for the wedding, you know, that poor couple.
Sure.
But I think it's a matter of like, keep like reassessing your product, you know, like you're looking at the band, like, what can we do better? What can happen better? How can we add new songs to be better? I mean, because if you think about it, we all at the end of the day play the same songs for the most part. Like I always joke, like we should have like a Best American Girl gig and have like 50 bands play the same song and give the money to charity, you know,
right.
Or the Best Rosalito, but whatever the hell, Sweet Caroline, whatever song it is, you know. But you know, it's funny though. You can watch one band play American Girl, then another girl and another band play it, and it can be a whole different animal. So I think as far as like the product you put out there, the vibe your band gives off, like, you know, like we had someone comment that, you know, they love that every gig, like you said, your friend does, like every member of the band came out and said hi at our table.
Right.
You know, because we do, and I'm sure you guys do. We do. Anyone that comes to see us, like, insanely appreciative, like never take it for granted, you know. And even with the pandemic, I mean, I almost took out a PPE loan in last January. Like I was panicking, you know. And the weird thing about this business, because I don't have a day job anymore, and I've learned to save money, because that other business I did when I started calling out all the BS, and they sort of terminated me because everyone was getting screwed basically, and
right.
I probably cost myself about $250,000 of sit on the couch, like residual money.
But right.
I feel like everything
sleep at night though.
It's all good, you know, but with what I do with the band, it's like, you know, 2023, I can have a really bad year. And, you know, that's one thing about being an entrepreneur, or, you know, believe it or not, like band leaders or whoever's like a Brian Kirk or Eddie, whoever, you know, Pat Roddy, you know, you're an entrepreneur, you're taking a risk every year. So that being said, if you don't put out a great product and you don't make that wedding couple want to, and again, all this is organically authentic with us. Like I'm not, me or Robin or anyone in the band aren't doing it because we read Tribes from Seth Godin, you know, but, you know, it, and I think people can see through bullshit. Like people are like dogs. They can sniff. Like when I used to do that old business, I'd sit down. It was the kind of business where you're pitching someone and all this kind of crap. Mm-hmm. And you could sniff someone, even the people like that were above me in the business, you could sniff out the bullshit artists, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think people are good at that, sniffing out authenticity. So I think one thing I always had on my side is, I mean, listen, in life, I think it's a blessing if you've had your teeth kicked in for humility wise, not like physically beat up. But there's no doubt in my life, I had my teeth kicked in many of times where no matter how big this band got, I don't think I could be an ego kind of person, or, you know, thinking who you are.
You know, there's an old saying,
thinking small.
Remember who you met on the way up, because they're the same people you're going to meet on the way down.
And
if that doesn't humble you, and it's true, because everybody you meet in life makes an impact on you, some positive, some not so much. But it doesn't matter. It's still an impact. It's a learning point. And you have to remember, there are people that should be kicked. There's no doubt there are people that should be kicked. But there are a lot more good people I found, no matter what. My wife says this, I'm to a fault. I always see the positives in people. I'm truly an optimist. I always see the positives. I don't have this, I can't trust people. I can't, you know, I trust you until you give me reason not to trust you. It's gotten me a lot further in life than being the opposite way, because the opposite way makes you paranoid and makes you close-minded and in a shell, and you don't take risk. You don't take opportunity. Like you just said, being an entrepreneur, it's risky. Everything's risky. There is no guarantee. There is no safety net. We fly without a safety net. They're not like at the circus where they have a net going down. If you fail as an entrepreneur, you're going to hit the ground. It's going to be it's over. It's finished. So you have to tactfully think about your plan, how you're going to do it, the people around you. You know, the old saying, you're a combination of people that you surround yourself with, and you surround yourself with some very good people. many of which, from what I understand, have been with you for a long time. Like, your people just don't go. And that's a true testament to bands. I've had friends that have called me and said, hey, this band's auditioning bass player, band's auditioning guitar player, whatever the case, what do you think? So I'll go, okay, if I don't know them personally, let's do the old due diligence like you do in any business. Let me find out a little more about them. And I'll tell you, 7 out of 10 times, I'll find out they have a massive turnover rate. And then I'll go, well, I wonder what the turnover rate is. So then you just start asking, what's the deal with these guys or whatever it is?
Yeah, why is that?
Yeah, you'll find out that it really has to do with usually one core person in the group that has a very big problem. And it's just, you know, and I decided when I joined Rock Bottom, I wanted to join because of the personalities. I liked the energy. I liked what they were doing. I always liked the band. Well before I was ever in the picture. But I liked that they had a good energy. I thought Rich was a very good front man, but he has a magnetic personality, and that magnetic personality drives people. And Rosie, you know, is the same way, and so forth. And all the guys, you know, we legitimately work as a group. We work together for a common goal. We make mistakes every night. We screw up every night. And thank God for it, because we're human.
Every band does.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, unless it's a major, I had my wireless die. I just charged it. It died. You know, what are you going to do? I always have a cable next to me. Grab it. Keep playing. Boom. Done. Because yeah. There is a what if to everything. And if you plan, for things that can inevitably happen. Shit happens. It's Murphy's Law. It happens. You have to be able to find a way to do that. But through that and through your growth in the music business, probably to a degree mine as well, you learn from experience, plan for something to happen. And it's a good day if it doesn't. But if it does, you roll with it. You don't stop and go, oh my God, you roll with it. And right. that's what defines success. That's what defines leadership. That's what defines a good leader. A leader will look at it and say, hey, try this. I played with the Jersey Shore band when I first got here. And I became the unofficial musical director of the band. Because the band, the singer would play things in a lower key, which was fine. But the guys that would come in didn't always know the lower key. So I'd have to be the person to say, hey, do this, drummer, do this. You know, drummer was pretty consistent. But whatever it was, you know, keyboard player, do this. Imagine telling a guitar player he's used to playing something, you know, an E, he's got to play it in E flat now. He's got to play it half a step down. And they're like, well, I got to transpose a solo. Just do your best. I never chew you up because you do your best. Is it going to be note for note? I've had one guy that pulled off note for note. I don't know how he did. Jeremy Renner, one of the best guitar players I've ever listened to, period. He's from down in Barnegat. Incredible player. He could do it in his head. I've never met anybody else that could transpose a whole guitar solo in their head and literally like duplicate it. But you do the best you can. And being an effective leader means you're managing people. And being an effective leader means you have to find a way to bring out the best in those people. And I think that's what you've done with your band is you've, like you said before, they bring out a lot in you, but then you bring out a lot in them. And that's what makes this thing work. That's what makes every successful business, music act, bands, that's what makes things work. It has to go to, if the leadership is poor, the system is poor. They say it, old Italian saying, the head rots from the snake down or something along those lines. Well, it's the truth. It rots from the head. So if you don't have good leadership at the top, it can't be, well, don't do as I say, don't do as I do as I say. It can't be that way. You got to be able to lead. Like you said, you get there early. Just quick story before we go any further. I show up to a gig on I've been sneaking there half an hour earlier to get to the show.
I was going to go to that show too.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, I get there
River
early.
River Rock.
And then yeah. which ended up good. And we Sweeney's, the same thing. So I get to Sweeney's Saturday night. We're playing. And I've been showing up half an hour early because I'm the sound man as well, which is another subject altogether I've talked to Ryan about. But it's a lot of work, and I set up everything. I set up pretty much the whole PA. I bring the PA with me. I run the sound, but I'm such a proactive person because I'm such a shitty reactive person. I want to make sure I can get everything up and running before I got people bringing in all their gear, putting, dropping off, whatever the case is. And it's a big circus and I don't want to do that. And the guys know it. So I would prefer to get there half an early. So I've been lying to our drummer, which is really, he's a great guy, Vinny. He'll show up and always tell me, he's like, going to be there an hour and a half ahead of time. He's an old school Brooklyn guy. Play with Debbie Gibson, the Village People. He's a wedding guy. He's a singer, believe it or not. And I tell him, yeah, Vinny, I'll be there at 7:30. And the gig is at 9:00. I get there at 7:00. Sweeney's, I get there, I pull in the side door right there. Sure as shit right behind me is that truck. He pulls up, he goes, I knew it. I freaking knew it. He goes, you get here, he goes, you should tell me you're going to get it. I says, well, I'm not going to drag you out 2 hours early. But for me, not having people around me, I'd rather almost, at the end of the night, I need your help. I'm spent. I moved around, jumped around. I'm a high energy kind of musician.
That's why I finally got a sound man.
I'm spent. So at the end of the night, I am hurting. Beginning of the night, I'm still pretty good. And yes, having a sound man is pray at some point.
We always joke with our drummer because me and the bass player, me and Chris, like we can't set up, especially in like wedding venues until he sets up.
Mm-hmm.
So like I'm there like 3 hours. Actually, Pat's really good. Like he's very rarely like cutting it close, you know, unless he has like a family emergency. But all my guys are, thank God. I mean, again, showing up on time, you know, bar gigs is one thing, but weddings, like you can't.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just, there's so much like nerve wracking things going on. Especially, yeah. I mean, we had one weekend where we did four in a row. We did Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday weddings. Oh. And every wedding was like playing the Parker House or Collins, like effing insane. And luckily Robin and I didn't lose our voices. It was a little rough by Sunday, but you know, another thing with singing that people don't realize, you know, basically I walk around with my moneymaker. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. if I get sick, like, you know, if you go out and drink too much or you talk, like, and when I met Rob Halford in California, when I was doing that metal band, we played something called the Concrete Forum. It doesn't mm-hmm. exist anymore, but every year it was this big metal convention and Kiss was on after us. We were like a side stage. I mean, I thought I was becoming a rock star at like 23 years old. And we had Rob Halford in the audience watching us the whole time. So wow. I'm sitting there going like, oh man, maybe we're going to open for Fight. Remember that band Fight he had?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but I even forget what the hell I was talking about, but, I forgot my train of thought.
Yo, oh, you're protecting your voice. About? You're talking about protecting.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yes. So we talked to Rob Halford and we could barely like hear him. Mm-hmm. Like you could barely hear him. We went and met him at a meet and greet. You can barely hear him. He was like, yeah, you know, with his English accent. And it's funny. We asked him for advice and we didn't take it, mm-hmm. but we go, you got any advice here? He goes, just keep writing. So when my band got signed, I think I mentioned that I left, mm-hmm. they wanted to hear like every song you had. Cause if when Van Halen got signed, they had like Mean Streets, they had like 50 songs and the label picked like 10, which two were covers.
Right.
So we obviously tried to write as much as we could, but you know, that's another thing with a cover band. We don't realize how another saying I learned from reading a book, a paradigm shift. That was a Stephen Covey thing. You know, when your brain makes a paradigm shift. So when I made the paradigm shift of I'm sick of playing American Girl from that frame of mind to the frame of mind of going, wait a minute, I didn't have to write this song. And it's a major hit, major Jersey Shore classic. And all I got to do is perform it. And I get paid to do it.
Right.
So what the hell are all these cover band people pissed about or too cool to play these songs? Like, who gives a shit? Because aren't you, if you're in a cover band and you're not doing it to make money, what are you doing it for? You might as well just play in your room and start a YouTube channel of you riffing.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Because, you know, of course, everyone does it for a side job or a job or whatever. So to me, it's like we almost have technically the easiest job in the world, because if you come from an original song band background, to just jump in and play covers. But I'll say this, there's a thing of Sting singing a cover song and it was so bad. So it goes to show you like Sting's, you know, one of the best ever.
Sure.
So it goes to show you like even a guy like Sting, like he's obviously couldn't be a cover band guy.
Yeah, you're talking about the nerd, or to talk about Jersey, we'll take the nerds. So their story is they became so popular, they wrote their own songs and to their own credit said they were awful. Awful original songs. And they realized one day they were very good at putting on a show and they were good, very good musicians, which they are. And that they could make a business and career out of being goofy and playing other people's songs and doing their own spin on other people's songs, which is truly what I think it's about. One of the things that irks me to no end is if I go out and see a band and it is perfect, I want to get up, just, I want to tell them what I really think about it, but I would never, like, if I want to listen to a CD or recording, I'll stay home. I want to listen to Chicago, I'll stay home. I want you to bring your...
Keep in mind, at weddings, they want that.
Do they really? They want it so perfect.
They want you to sound good.
Oh, I'm sure they want you to sound good, but do they want you to sound absolutely like the record or your own version of that song?
Well, I don't think we tee out anything. I think we do our own version. Like, we've had a few people that work weddings that came up to us and said, we thought a DJ was on, because we don't, we have signals. Like I have signals with songs with the band. Like, we'd never have a set list, even at a wedding. So we very rarely stop. Right. And a part of that was always, I never wanted to talk and be a front man anyway. Okay. So we can literally do an hour and a half set with not maybe a second break between a song to go one, two, you know? Right. So we're seamless with that. But I know what you mean. Like the nerds, I mean, they started what, in the 80s or something.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, the Amish Outlaws jumped on that. And it's funny, me and the Amish Outlaws singers, we became friends on Facebook. I'd love to do a show with them.
Good guys. Real good
he
guys.
He always sends me these weird metal avant-garde like YouTube videos, because we're both like metalheads. Yeah. It's funny. We're both shaved heads now. But yeah, the nerds, I mean, they built the brand.
Right.
You know, so people just know that name. I mean, just from that silly movie. They were smart enough, and they had Steve Tarkanish. That was like, sure. From what I hear. I mean, how would I know? But he was like an equal band member.
He was
promoting them.
He was, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, they were great, and you know, they without a doubt didn't invent cover bands. I mean, Twisted Sister was a cover band. Van sure. Halen was a cover band. The Beatles were a cover band.
Right.
If did you ever read the book Outliers?
I have.
You know, they say the Beatles played like 10,000 hours, like tons of cover gigs.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, that's another thing. You look at the book Outliers.
Yep.
All the bands we pretty much mentioned today have done that many hours of playing together. I mean, me, Chris, and Pat, and John, which is drums, bass, guitar, and piano, we've easily logged in 10,000 hours.
Sure.
So it's like we've done a lot of trio gigs where, mm-hmm. you know, we would just rock out trio gigs all the time. And it was just, you know, I mean, my bass player has a phenomenal voice. You know, Pat Roddy actually hires him because Pat likes his backing vocals.
Yep.
You know, so
I'm gonna
obviously
tell you,
Pat's the one band that I always tell Chris, I don't mind you playing with him. It'll all go make money. You know,
I actually went to a convention because of my business. I went to an Atlantic City Realtors convention, and who's playing the Realtor convention? Brian Kirk and the Jerks. Now, I know Brian on and off for many, many years, and always respected him. Always thought he did it, you know, as the words of Frank Sinatra, the right way. So I get up there and I start talking to him. The first set, he goes, come on up. He knows the band. He knows me. And he goes, come up and sing a song. No, I'm not here for that. I'm just going to sit there and watch. I'm good, man. I do my fair share of performing. No big deal. Second set comes around. He goes, you ready yet? I'm like, you're not going to let this go. No. So I'll come up and sing. So I did Summer 69, which I am not. I sing it. People seem to like the way I do it. I think I destroy it, and not in a good way. Just don't have that raspiness voice. I have a smooth, high Cetera type range, but not that, right. Not that type of voice. But people like it. So I get up and I sing it. And of course, they're using all in-ears. There's no stage monitors, not one. And you're in a boomy room, a pool. It's a room with a pool. It's the pool room at the water club.
Right. Yeah. I saw you posted it on Facebook.
Horrible acoustics. Horrible. Like the worst acoustics you could get. So you got nothing but sound bouncing around. And Brian's next to me, and he's got the inners. Everybody's got the inners. So I'm playing the song, I'm singing, and I'm praying to myself, listen to your head voice, listen to your knowledge, listen to what you learned, how to sing a song. Don't listen to anything else in the room and sing. I know you've been doing it for a while, but you can't hear anything. And you won't know if you're off other than you're just telling yourself. So I sang the whole song, and Brian gets over. He goes, dude, you got some serious pipes. I don't even know how you heard yourself. I got Kevin Safara behind me, one of the best drummers in the country. You know, an incredible guy, incredible musician. Same thing. He's like, I don't know, man. That was perfect pitch. That was this. He's like, how did you know you were right on? I said, I didn't. I mentally pictured singing the song from what I've done so many times, and I forgot that I could not hear myself at all, and that I was in a room and I was sitting next to, you know, Dave Pershon, which I think is one of the best musicians. I mean, these guys all around me are they're all world-class players. I'll be honest. Yeah. All those guys on the stage are world-class players.
Dave might be the top guy in New Jersey.
Just sitting there, I'm like, if I'm going to get nervous with anybody, I wouldn't get nervous with Prince if he was still alive, but I would get nervous with Brian Kirk and the Jurys because that's what I do. I play covers. So to go up there and do that and not hear it and go, oh God, this can go terrible. Very bad. Very quickly to get them going. That was unreal. Whatever, you know, let's stay in touch, blah, blah, blah. And I'm such a fan of the band. I'm a fan of him and what he's accomplished and this stuff. Yeah, you realize that you have that mental thing in the back of your brain, that singing thing. Obviously, I'm seriously doubt it was pitch perfect, but it was probably not at a key, and thank God for it. But you have to go blindly into the light and go, screw it, I got to make it happen. You know, you can't worry about it. You can't think about what you're going to hit the bad notes. If you hit a bad note, you hit a bad note. But you have to do the best you can to mentally prepare yourself to do what you need to do to be a quote unquote pro. And I think if people like what you're saying and your band members and things have more of that ability to excel and excel within your organization, like I said before, it brings out that, and that comes across when you're entertaining wedding guests, when you're entertaining private events, when you're attending bar gigs. People feed off that. They see that. If they don't feel it here, they don't feel it in you. They're not, like you said before, they're not stupid. They're not going to buy it. It's just right. Like buying a bad drink. We think that's a watered down whiskey sour, you know, so I don't want to buy it from, they're going to feel it and they feed off that. We played the River Rock the other night. That's all it was just people going nuts. And I mean, I'm not talking, you know, 20 somethings here. Right? There were a couple 20 somethings there. Most of them were over 40 that were in front of us. And to get them as excited as a kid, that meant more to me because I know the 20 something's going to jump around. I mean, that's I did a 20 something.
Haven't you noticed? And we've pretty much become like 80% private, 20% bar gigs. But I've noticed over the last 7 years, there's way more older people out. Either I guess the divorce rates is through the roof, but there's more older people out, which is cool. And you know, like the gigs are earlier,
right?
Like I remember starting at like 10:30 playing to 1:30 all the time. Those days are
decades,
which are cool in a way.
Yeah.
No, those are over with. You know, unless obviously the columns or certain places in the summer are different. Like this summer, we have some really cool, you know, I don't really branch out to too many rooms. I mean, like I said, I don't like the process of it. Especially like it's funny, Eddie Tessa and I were talking and he goes, cause I referred him for some weddings or whatever. And he goes, man, it's like, you got to prove yourself over and over again. And I go, there's like 70% of the brides that I got to prove myself to. Like,
yeah.
Like, believe it or not, it's not like our reputation is great, but you're still like, those days are still there. Like with us, I still feel like we have to prove ourselves, but it's almost like I'm a big UFC fan and MMA and stuff like that.
Sure.
And so I watch all the training videos and stuff like that. But you know, one thing that's cool about it is like, if you look at it, like if you're a fighter, once you like Conor McGregor, like obviously everyone knows who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get fat and bloated and you think you're the shit, you're done.
You know, so your ass.
Once you start taking things for granted, mm-hmm. there's going to be a younger, hungrier kid underneath you. That's you're not going to see it coming.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, getting back to someone wants to take your lunch, and by no means am I like worried about. You know, there's plenty of bands that are way above me that probably look that way with other bands and us, whoever. But you know, it's like, if you don't have that hunger, and it's got to be a combination of passion, hunger, and enjoying doing it. So people definitely have said to us that you guys genuinely seem like you get along,
mm-hmm.
and they like that. So if you see bands where they're like, you know, giving it, like you can tell when bands hate each other.
Oh yeah.
And people feed off that. So, but yeah, getting back to the way you opened up, I think the music business is probably the toughest business because it's very small and it's very intricate. It's not like the real estate. It's funny, like the other business I did, by the way, was network marketing, multi-level marketing pyramid sure. business. And you know, like Keller Williams is like a pyramid, Exit right. 76, like you can recruit people. I love the idea of, you know, leverage income. It's not, obviously that's great. But, you know, I remember pitching real estate people going, and then 2 years later, they're getting trained by MLM people. You got to build a brand. You're like, the world has totally shifted. And I read another book called I'll Shut Up When I'm Dead. It's from Jerry Weintraub, one of my best buddies, Sandy Cerami, who's like a car consultant. And he pretty much goes into car dealerships and motivates the sales force and stuff. And he's killing it. He's an entrepreneur that, you know, like, think about it. And with music, you basically take a nothing. Like, think about it, like Joe Barracata Band. Like, really, people, like, when I started booking gigs and I have this silly Staten Island accent still left in me somewhere. So you're in the Irish Riviera and they're like, what do you want to be? Like, Joe Barracata Band. Like, so the fact that I always tell my bass player, the fact that we're even where we are, and I'm like, you know, some Gindaloon from Staten Island that no one can pronounce our name, is almost a testament in itself. But anyway, getting back to Jerry Weintraub, the opening statement starts out, and it's great to listen. You would love this book. I'll text it to you. It's,
okay.
I listened to it over a week riding my bike. It's all stories about Elvis Zeppelin, because he was like a manager of them. Mm-hmm. And he basically says, the only thing I learned in my 70 years is that every 10 years, like, your life's going to change. Like, everything's going to be different. So in the music business, think about this. Like, we just saw, I was joking around with some bar owners and promoters. We just saw, like, the most holiday shows ever in the history of the Jersey Shore, with 90,000 horns in every band. So who knows? Like, you might turn around and see, like, the horn bands are just not happening anymore in 5 years right from now. People might want, like, guitar riffs and double guitar players. Like, there was a point where in 2011, I really got into 106.3, and we learned about 40, 50 country songs.
Right.
And, like, not to, I mean, listen, who cares who was the first guy playing Country Girl as Zac Brown? It really doesn't matter. Right. But we were playing that shit in, like, 2010, and it brought in a whole new crowd of people where we started doing an every Wednesday country night at the Boathouse.
Right.
So in business, if you don't keep reinventing yourself, you're dead. And that's another hard thing being an entrepreneur. Like, you can't, once you're comfortable, there's like a saying in business, second you're comfortable is when to get scared. Like, you always have to be proactive of, 100%. Well, I'm doing great now, but what's coming? Like, some of those webinars I got on, you know, like, I found out that the average bride's attention span is 8 seconds. So if you think you're going to do this 4-minute killer video and lip sync it and get everything perfect, maybe their parents might, but they're not going to get past the first 15 seconds of it.
Right.
And then they're going to be like, next. So yeah, the music business is just, it really is an insane business. And if you can survive in this, it's almost like you got to have some kind of nuttiness to you, you know, well, it's just,
yeah, but it's a great teacher. All right. So if you can, I started the music business when I was a kid. I learned the business side of it by the time I was 17 years old. And that taught me, I mean, I've ran other businesses, multi-million dollar businesses for other people before I ever went on my own in 2005. And it's a pattern, you know, it's a system that you follow to work within. I did much more in the private sector than I will ever do in the music business because I started from the music business and understood. And I've always said from day one, if you can master that and people's likes and interest and pay attention, two ears, one mouth, you'll be far better off than a person that talks it. And one of the biggest struggles I have, and I've had to do this myself as a podcast host, is sometimes I'll have a guest on. Now, you have been very engaging and you've talked, but sometimes I'll get somebody that's not, or I'm not sure if they're going to say anything. And I realize that if I have dead air for half a second, I've lost somebody. So I'm mentally in my mind preparing what I'm going to say ahead of time if you don't say it.
Right.
And you have to do it. But I also had to say, shut up. Listen, they're going to teach you something. And I had a friend of mine in that owns a plumbing company, very successful one here on the Jersey Shore. And I said afterwards, I watched it back. And I went, I'm very sorry, Ryan. I stepped all over you. And he goes, no, you didn't, man. You were going over the whole routine. He's like, I says, no, I wasn't. I wasn't listening to you. He goes, but you kept it. I says, but I wasn't listening. And he goes, you weren't listening. And the truth was, I mean, he knew it and I knew it. And I didn't realize at the time, because I'm going and I'm in the moment and you want to keep it going. You want to keep it engaging, because that's what you look at those metrics when it comes to people listening and you want to make it really engaging. But you have to learn to shut up.
Getting back to the personal development, like, there was a point, like, where you're reading so many books and some of your colleagues are the same. And, you know, you ever see the movie What About Bob?
Sure.
Bill Murray and mm-hmm. Richard Dreyfuss. That's the greatest movie to watch to keep yourself in check if you ever think you're like, because there was a point where I was reading so many books, I had this weird enlightenment feeling on me. It was like, holy shit, I digest. My friend was calling me Lawnmower Man. He's like, you're digesting like 4 books a week and you're listening to them over and over again. But then you watch What About Bob? And remember, he was supposed to be the relationship expert person.
Yes.
And here comes Bill Murray, homeless guy. And it, you know, that's like, I think for someone that has really been into personal development, that's a good movie to watch just to keep yourself in check and to allow yourself to say, hey, listen, you might know 2 ears and 1 mouth, but it's okay if you screw up every once in a while. As long as you like, you caught yourself. Like, I think catching yourself a lot is the awareness of it and being right. aware of things that helps you grow as a person. But it's a never-ending journey. I mean, I've met people that I know hardly read books, and you would think they read like 1,000 books because they just, their personality, they have their demeanor. They're good. Like, if you watch the Paul McCartney thing with Rick Rubin, I was saying to my mother-in-law the other day, I go, he amazes me, this guy. And I didn't grow up a Beatles fan because a lot of my friends that were Beatles fans, they're fucking snobs and they turn you off to the Beatles. You ever notice some Beatles fans think they wrote the Beatles songs?
Yep.
It's like, dude, you didn't write the songs. Like, it's cool to be their fan, but don't think you're them. And a lot of fans are like that. Like, I love Van Halen, but I certainly didn't come up with any of these tapping techniques. But Paul McCartney listened to Rick Rubin. Like, he was very interested in his take on the songs that he mastered 50 years ago.
Right.
So even watching Paul McCartney, you sit there and go, here's a guy that's got everything any of us would want ever, and still he's an impeccable human being in this video. And it really blew my mind to say, like, hey, if this guy can be that refined and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, so courteous to Rick Rubin, because I was saying with my mother-in-law, who's a huge like Beatles fan, we watched it the other day, and she goes, how did he get this? And I go, that's a good point, because I'm sure every record producer wanted that gig. Think about it. Who didn't want to be on that?
I have a feeling the reason he got the gig with that is because of what he did with Johnny Cash.
Possibly, yeah.
Because Johnny Cash's career was done. And then he remade an album that was, I can't tell you, even that was remotely, because I grew up listening to Johnny Cash.
Is that with the Hurt remake?
Yeah. The what do you call it? Which is, I forget who.
The Nine Inch Nails song.
Nine Inch Nails song. But he did a great, and was totally different. And I actually preferred it to the Nine Inch Nails version. It took me a while to do it. But think about that. He was able to recreate a case. Now, Rich, I was just talking to him. We got done at Sweeney's. We were tearing down everything. And he's talking about the Beatles movie or whatever that just came out. Now, like you, I was a Queen fan growing up. Van Halen, Queensryche, big Jeff Tate fan, you know, metal rock. And then I grew up listening to a lot of jazz. So jazz was a massive influence to me as well. I'm going somewhere with this. I know I am. So Rich was saying, did you see the Beatles movie yet? And I was like, no, you know, I'm a Beatles fan from a respect standpoint. But I'm not that. He goes, you got to watch this. And Paul McCartney is clearly the leader in the band when you watch.
Now, you know, there's two of them, right? I don't mean to cut you off.
Sure.
There's one with Rick Rubin, and then there's one where they're just showing them writing songs.
That's the one Rich is talking about. They're writing the songs.
The Rick Rubin one to me was way better. It's easy to follow.
I'll have to watch it. I'm a Rubin fan just because he's a genius.
What's great about that one is Paul McCartney's listening to songs that he hasn't heard the like track wise, and he's like a little kid. Like it as a musician, like I couldn't stop watching. It was like the other one was great. I mean, you know, it's them like stoned out, like doing the album. Yoko sitting right by John. I enjoyed that, but not as much as the Rick Rubin one. The Rick Rubin one was just, you know.
I'll have to watch
it. I mean, obviously, if you're a Beatle fanatic, the Get Back one is, you know, I mean, that would be like me watching the Van Halen record their first 4 albums, you know.
I think I get the opinion Rich definitely was. I wouldn't have thought of him as a Beatles fan, but he definitely, gave me all the stories of how this person did this, and he was the leader, and he had to put them all together, and he remembers Harrison walking out of the room, I quit the band, and they having to pull him down, say, you got to come back. And he's just telling me all these stories. And of course, I felt terrible because I'm looking at him while I'm wrapping up cables and doing whatever we needed to get the hell out of the bar. But he's going on. He's telling me the whole story. And by the time I got there, he sold me. I was going to watch it. The person that turned me onto the Beatles, believe it or not, was here in New Jersey. I'm not a native New Jersey. I moved here 4 years ago. Okay. I've been in and out of New Jersey. The Jersey for me was playing Wildwood for a week, you know, when I was young. All right, so that's the Jersey for me. I didn't get to this side of the Jersey Shore. It was Mike Dalton. Mike is a huge Beatles fan.
Oh, yeah, Mike loves them.
And but listening to Mike explain more about what was behind it and why he likes him so much. And I have a personal, you know, I have a personal connection to Mike because when I first came to New Jersey, a friend of my wife's had passed. She was fighting cancer. She eventually passed, unfortunately. And I needed to find some entertainment. Our band 3 Days was going to play the benefit, but I needed somebody else that could play. We had to be up in Lake Hopatcong for a show that night or something crazy like that. And I reached out to Mike and Mike said yes without a second. And I was like, wow, that's a quick answer, Mike. I appreciate it. You don't know me, you know, at all. I know of you. He's like, I lost my bass player to the same thing that your friend is fighting. And he says, I would never convince no. And I love the guy from that day on. And I've whenever I get time to go see him, I do as a person and to God.
That's very cool. Nick was a nice guy too.
I heard he was Beatles, a really nice guy.
You know what I love about music? It's like, I mean, obviously I'm a huge Van Halen fan, but obviously the Beatles were a better band. But, you know, again, like music is what it does to you personally. So there's no right or wrong. But the Beatles are like even the Beatles and the Stones I got into later on because right. I was, you know, I was very naive as a music fan. If you weren't like a Neil Peart or an Eddie Van Halen, I wasn't really listening to you as a young kid.
Right.
But as I started singing and, you know, one thing that's astonishing is Paul McCartney admits he doesn't know theory like at all. Every song he wrote was just winging it, whatever sounded right. So, you know, the Beatles catalog is there. I'm not dead yet. I mean, my daughter, her wedding song is a Beatles song. Like she loves the Beatles. So we play some Beatles songs. We learned some really cool songs like, you know, Do You Wanna Know a Secret?
Sure.
That was a Groom Brian's wedding song. And he comes out to see us every once in a while. So, I mean, that's what's great about music. I mean, and I'll say, you know, I know we've been going long or whatever, but which we're having a good time.
Yeah. I'm okay with that. I always try to keep it to that, but that there's no,
right. No, that's cool. Listen, we're shooting the shit. That's fun conversations.
Yeah.
What I love about doing weddings the most is we end up learning songs I never would think of playing. Like we learned like Toy Story, like You Got a Friend in Me. You just end up learning songs like Don't Stop Me Now. We play it now live.
You too, yeah.
You might love
friend. That song. And I'll be honest, right. When we learned it, Rosie wanted to do it. And
I dropped it like 25 keys, by the way.
We still do it in the original for some odd reason. It is. She's got to sing it because God knows none of us probably could.
Yeah, no, for a guy to sing it, you got to drop it.
Yeah. So should we do that? And I remember, and I'm like, I said to my wife, I was like, how is it? Like, I knew it as a big Queen fan, but I'm like, how do people know this? She goes, it was in the movie.
It was the movie, yeah.
She goes, it was in the movie. Every one of them know it. So people go ballistic over playing that song. And I'm like, God, I knew it as a diehard Queen fan, but I never knew it as like people would give a damn about hearing it as in a cover situation, but it's a huge song.
You have kids or no?
I have stepkids.
Okay. So think about this. Like we used to play It's My Life. And then I noticed it was going over like a lead balloon. So my daughter has arthritis and we used to do these arthritis walks and she's walking with all her friends and they're screaming, It's My Life. And I'm like, And she was like 15. So that night we played the Parker House and the band always knows if I just do a pick scratch, that means go bound, bound, go into the song. So right. We don't have to say the song. They looked at me like, what are you doing? I was like, watch. All the kids went nuts at the Parker House and they go, why'd you call that song out? I go, because I saw Gabby singing it. So right. Where you and I grew up to like radio or MTV, these kids really, they do have their own music, but they don't like we did. So if they're watching Glee or whatever movie's big, so you never know what's big nowadays. Like the music scene, in a way, it's a good thing because, I mean, I've had wedding couples reach out to me and like eventually not want to hire us because we're not a total top 40 band playing the weekend. Right. And that's fine. I always say, listen, we'll learn a few songs. It is what it is. But bands like us and a Brian Kirk and whoever's doing a lot of weddings can exist because people still like the classics just keep getting like circulated. Yeah. Like there'll be a time where maybe Queen won't be hot anymore. And I'm waiting for the time that Van Halen puts out a movie and we can play like 30 Van Halen songs a night.
It's going to happen. It will hopefully happen before both retired.
I mean, I'm joking, but you never know. But yeah, even Elton John, like kids know Elton John now. My daughter's taste in music. Like I love the fact that she knows like all like, I mean, she got married, she doesn't live home anymore, but she has a vinyl record player. And like, you know, she just loves the Beatles and loves Elton John and like all this kind of stuff. So it's
they
just
grew up with everything. You know, they grew up listening to what we listened to. Like, I think about it. When I was a kid, we had the Carpenters on the radio. My dad would have Coltrane, jazz, Motown, lots of Motown. Like, that influences me the most as a bass player. If you're not influenced by the Motown, dude, I don't know what to tell you.
James Jamerson,
Bob Babbitt. There's so many, you know, the legendary Motown, and that's you know, Stax Records and all that era where that you know, really was groove oriented stuff. And also, same thing as I hated disco, despised it until I became a bass player and went, oh my freaking God. Yeah. It's intertwined. And the best players played.
We played We Are Family for the first time at a wedding with a killer bass line.
And then you
find out my bass player told me that, what's his name? Jamerson?
James Jamerson, yes.
He played on almost every Motown album, and half of them, he was hung over on the floor one take.
And he did it with one finger. They call it the hook. He would play like this, and the action was like an upright bass because he started on upright bass.
Right.
And he would go like this. And I can't do it with three fingers, and this dude did it with one. And I've listened to Jamerson a lot. I've listened to jazz artists a lot. That is my big influence on the bass. But those variables come into this mosh. I always said I'm a rock player secondary. I'm the world's worst pick bass player you have ever seen. I am I can play guitar with one, but I cannot hold on to a pick playing bass.
I actually played bass for about 3 years when I was like 18 to like, no, 17, 18, 19. I learned Shy Boy, but it was like, you know, I was more into being a guitar player. And
you're talking about a humble guy there, Billy Sheehan, one of the best rock players of all time. And the nicest person in the world. Couldn't say a bad thing about, and the devil could be in front of him. He would say, the devil's not a bad guy. You know,
he's got a lot of gratitude. You could see it in him. And
humbling.
I mean, I think anyone that's a musician for the most part usually has a lot of influences you wouldn't know about. I mean, like, my favorite guitar album is actually Casino from Al Di Meola.
Oh, God.
Like,
yeah.
I wasn't a huge jazz guy, but I loved Al Di Meola. Like, that one album, like a lot of his other albums, he's just ripping.
Yeah.
I love Yngwie, like Steve Vai. I was hugely into David Gray until I met him. Guy was such a dick, but he had a bad day. But I love David Gray. Zach Brown was probably the last band I got into that I bought all his albums. And he's another band. People thought he was an overnight success. They were a bar band for like 20 years.
Hell no. The two bands that influenced me, I'll tell you a quick story. This goes back to as a kid. My father worked at a, you know, Caterpillar, the bulldozers. He worked at one of those facilities for a long time. And they were one of the early adapters to dealing with diesel motors. Well, the tour buses were all diesel back then. Now they're biodiesel, they're whatever the case was. But the motors, you know, they put these motors that could run a million miles plus, and they would survive. So Chicago, when they came through the area, because I lived off Route 80 and 81, where they did. My father worked at the boot of 81, would go right past them. They would come in and get their work done, their service work done on the trucks. And my dad would once in a while, I'd get down there and I'd see the buses and he'd say, whatever. One day I'm home. My dad worked second shift at that point, and I'm home with the kid, and I'm already playing music. I started playing when I was like 7, 8 years old, and I was playing fluently at 14. So I'm like not even a teenager, the young kid. And he goes, gets a call from work, and he's like, hey, we're going to go down to my work. I'm like, no, I don't want to go work. He's like, no, you want to go. So we get down to the thing, and we get there, and then his boss comes out and meets him. He goes to my dad. My dad's paraphrasing. I don't remember this. He goes, yeah, I talked to him. He's good. And I get up and I go onto the bus. At the top of the bus is standing Robert Lamb, the genius behind Chicago. As a kid, I'm sitting on his lap as a kid. Okay. You know, on the bus with Chicago. By the way, Chicago's my favorite band of all time. It's that to me is, I'm getting chills right now mentioning their name. But it goes back to as a kid. He goes, you used to listen to their albums because I would tell you about this band. I wanted you to know who they were as a kid. He made me listen to Pink Floyd, Genesis.
And you absorb it as a kid.
I absorbed it. But Chicago, he says, you just as a kid, you like this was the best thing in the world to you. Toto is another I'm a big fan of for obvious reasons. But Chicago, I just adapted to this day. And my wife, you know, I go upstairs right now. Who's your favorite band? Chicago. I mean, that's just the epitome of it. But it all started with meeting Robert Lamb as a little kid. Now, I don't remember the physical meeting of the guy.
Right.
I remember going there, but it's so spotty. But my father used to say, yeah, you met Robert Lamb. You got your first meeting with a rock star when you were like 10, 11 years old.
That's, you know, that's awesome. I mean, shit, I wish I met someone like that. That's cool. My mom always listened to Chicago, George Benson, and the Commodores.
Oh.
So like as a kid, I didn't realize like, you know, like, I mean, obviously she made me learn. I learned half of the Commodores albums. Like when I was a kid as a drummer, which I wish I had this knowledge on guitar, I don't. And I always break my drummer's chops. Like, why don't you chart shit out? He's like, I don't know how to do it. So I would have my drum teacher come over and we wouldn't even, I got to the point where we would sit at my table. And let's say I'd say like, I want to learn, you know, getting more advanced. What do you want to learn this week? And what he meant by that is, what do you want to learn how to transcribe? So I might say like Mean Streets. He knew I loved Van Halen. We did a lot of Rush. Mm-hmm. I actually transcribed like YYZ. Like when I was 12, I can actually play that shit.
Wow.
It's weird. Drums, as you know, drums and guitar, it's like if you stop doing it, you lose a little of your chops.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then my lesson that week was now take what you transcribed and put it on your drums. But my mom is the reason why I got into music. Like she's the one that pushed me to do it. She always had music on in the house. My dad's more of like a jock kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
My dad used to joke. He's like, cause me and my brother had long hair. He's like, well, your mother always wanted girls. We were the long haired dudes. And I remember the lead singer of my band in like 89 with the older band we joined, we took photos like in Manhattan, like with just big shot photographer. We had like pancake makeup on. We all washed it off. He didn't. Like my dad's like, who's this guy coming in my house? So and I'll tell you, man, as you know, when you grow up, like my parents not only put up with a drummer, but then my band would record songs in my room. Like my Marshall would be like 10 on my Tascam. And my dad's like, you almost done already? Like trying to get a feedback for like 3 hours. So thank God we had parents that were willing to like put up with it.
Drums were not an option to me. I had little boxes that I had to smack on. That was the end of that. They're like, no, you're not. You're going to play guitar. All right. So I played guitar. And that's it. And I got into unintentional singing by playing with a band where our keyboard player sounded very much like Jeff Tate. And the cool thing is he sounded like Jeff Tate. The bad thing was he sounded like Jeff Tate. Right. So when you were trying to do Journey or something else, he wouldn't. So got into singing by learning that we had to be versatile. So it was one of those things. I don't mean to hold you up anymore. We could probably talk for quite a bit of time.
No, I had a great time, man. Thanks
yeah,
so
me
much
too, man. I really appreciate your time here. And I know we went a lot longer and I appreciate you giving it. How can people find out about you? I'll put the link to Joe Barricotta Band and your Instagram in the show notes and things like that. But how can people find out more about you? And if they're interested in obviously hiring your band for their private events or their weddings?
I mean, our website is joebarricotta.com. We're on Instagram as Joe Barricotta Band, as well as Facebook. It has all our dates. We have a Stone Pony show on January 29th. That's our next show. We actually have Smoking Jackets opening up for us. But, you know, or just right on our website is my cell number. So if anyone's interested in checking out the band or, you know, hiring us for an event, just send me a text.
That's awesome.
Email.
Man.
Everything's on there. So I'm pretty open with everything.
Yeah, me too, man. There's the only way to be. That's the other thing I found real quick in closing, that I found bands that are successful, people that are successful in this business, will help each other out. We'll talk to each other. They're cordial. I found that, you know, there are musicians that I can say I've met in New Jersey that aren't the nicest people in the world, but the ones that I've found are respectable, that know their stuff, that know their craft, that aren't worried and really don't see everybody as necessarily direct competition. They realize we're all in this to do something. And like the business world, our enemy is never the person that's doing it right. It's the person that's doing it wrong. So the person that goes and does something incorrect, if your band is garbage and it's cheap, you're going to bring down the whole thing. You're going to commoditize it to something. It's the same thing in the business world. If you got a competitor that's, you know, is really lowballing you and just doing crappy work, now everybody gets a reputation for being unreliable, doing poor work, and whatever the case is. But I found that in the business here, especially the music business in New Jersey, that the people that will help each other, will be behind each other, can run things off each other, and have that open ability to talk, and that's what this has been really a lot about today. And Joe, again, thank you so much for being here. It's really been an honor, and we got to do another one at some point in time.
Definitely, man.
We got to pull Ryan into it next time. All right, buddy, have a good night.
All right, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.